After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the Metta Hour with Sharon Salzberg, where Buddhist wisdom meets everyday life. This podcast is brought to you by the Be Here Now Network and features interviews with the top leaders, teachers, and thinkers of the mindfulness movement and beyond. For more information, visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Sharon.
Hi, I'm Sharon Salzberg, and I'm talking today with my good friend, Bonnie Pittman. Bonnie is a nationally recognized leader in the museum community. Her career spans 50 years of service in the museum, education, and university fields. She's a nationally recognized leader whose expertise in research and audience and civic engagement have transformed museums and their work with audiences. Bonnie was the Eugene McDermott Director of the Dallas Museum of Art, and served as deputy director for 12 years, and has served as a curator, educator, and administrator at the University of California's Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archives, Seattle Art Museum, New Orleans Museum of Art, Winnipeg Art Gallery, and the Bay Area Discovery Museum. Since 2008, Bonnie has been living with a chronic illness. In 2011, she began her daily practice to do something new, inviting the exploration and celebration of making an ordinary day extraordinary while dealing with chronic illness. Welcome to the podcast, Bonnie.
Thank you, Sharon. It's wonderful to be with you and all of our friends today.
It's just wonderful to be with you. Even hearing your voice makes me happy, as we had just said. So I thought maybe we could start the conversation with just a little bit more about your journey. You've had such an extraordinary career. You faced some pretty immense health challenges still facing. So let's start with what drew you to art and inspired you to work in that realm.
Well, from the time I was a little girl, I knew artists as major parts of my community because I grew up in Provincetown, Massachusetts. And in my neighborhood was Hans Hofmann and Robert Motherwell and Helen Frankenthaler. So I thought that was something that you did in life, seriously, was be a practicing artist. My mother and my grandmother loved art, and they took me to the National Gallery of Art, which was the very first place that I saw truly great paintings. And two of them stay with me even to today. One is a Tondo, a circular painting by Raphael of a Madonna and child. And the other is a beautiful little Renoir portrait of a girl holding a watering can. I always thought I was that little girl in the blue dress, blue velvet dress. But the reason I love art is that artists tell stories, and they create beautiful things that resonate with our soul. And for me, it was the joy of being in their presence. And I can close my eyes now and see the same images that I did when I was a little girl. My long career in museums has a lot to do with the fact that I love the collections of museums, and in art museums in particular, it's like a visual dictionary or encyclopedia, and you can learn everything you need to know about the world and love and sex and war. Mm-hmm. The other part is that I'm very dyslexic, and mm-hmm. so the visual world was one I understood. I have a very powerful visual memory, But reading and writing were huge challenges. And so understanding the world through space and place and with objects has been the way that I've navigated and succeeded.
Wow, that's so incredible. Speaking as somebody who's very, very tied to words, you know. I think for many, you know, as they think about art, it's maybe enjoyment or entertainment or something, but not necessarily an entryway or very connected to contemplative practice. But it does seem to me that a big part of your motivation in curation mm-hmm. is to facilitate deeper questions. And I'm wondering if you can say a little bit about how you see art fitting into life and what yeah. role it can play in our experience.
Well, the gift we have is that human beings from Paleolithic times have created works of art, the hand paintings on the caves of Lascaux or all around the world. Art tells these stories, as I mentioned, of our lives, our successes, our failures, of the tragedy and the beauty of being in this world. And these visual records are really very similar to the stories that we see in literature. Observing art for me is very much is very similar to a mindfulness activity because you're stepping into the presence of the work and focusing on for a moment, for a period of time, deeply and observing in details and purposefully and intentionally with all of your senses, and then trying to understand what the art story the artist is telling you without making judgments. In Buddhism, as you know, Sharon, there's a huge tradition of art being created for the past 2,500 years. And it's used specifically there as a vehicle of meditation. And what I love is that in Buddhist art, we have not only the paintings and calligraphy and poetry and gardening, but it's also flower arrangements and tea ceremonies. Of all of the art forms in Buddhist art, the one that resonates the most with me are the great mandala sand paintings. Mm-hmm. They are so intended to demonstrate this key thought that art is temporary. Its mm-hmm. meaning is timeless. Art is temporary, but its meaning is timeless. And the colorful mandalas, with all of their exquisite detail and the deep meanings that they have in the individual symbols in it, are then brushed away at the end of the week in a breathless, for me, ceremony. They're destroyed mm-hmm. and gathered up. And then the sand that is gathered up is dispersed into water, and the mandala's healing powers are carried forward. So that concept of interconnectedness of all of the work of art being really a part of life and the future is very much, very much in the presence. In Buddhist art, it goes on for so many wonderful examples, but I just want to mention another very different artist, Claude Monet, who is a painter of the moment. And he did five series of in his thousands of paintings that he created, representing the different times of day, the seasons of the year, and specifically focused on how light was affecting water lilies, haystacks, Rouen Cathedral, the Houses of Parliament, or even simple poplar trees. And he painted them over and over again, so that he could understand the dramatic differences of the interplay of light. And seeing the same thing over and over again in different ways is a celebration that's very much a part of the practice of my Do Something New and also of meditation.
It's definitely a very Buddhist thing, you know.
It is a very Buddhist thing. You're right.
Let's repeat that. It's very true. And, you know, I'm also listening to, I'm thinking about a conversation I've talked about many times on this podcast that I had with bell hooks some years mm-hmm. ago when I was working on the book Real Change, which was sort of about the inner work of mindfulness and outer manifestations of bringing change to the world. And Bell Hooks told me that she didn't really like the term social action, because she said for some people it might only imply protesting or marching or something like that. And she looked at me and she said, what about art?
Yeah.
You know, which might totally dissolve our stuck place, you know, or some idea that we're holding that suddenly we're looking from another perspective altogether.
Right. And that's what artists do. I mean, there are so many artists that use this in this changing perspective in their artwork. Richard Diebenkorn did 145 paintings of ocean parks in the Ocean Park series, basically looking out his window to the Pacific Ocean. And they're totally abstract. You wouldn't necessarily know that they were, you know, this view of the beautiful blue Pacific. And the colors change in all of them, and the abstract forms change in all of them, but there's a resonance there. And there's so many artists, Duchamp or Brancusi, Georgia O'Keeffe, who do this over and over again because they see something anew. And that new is the gift that they then share with us. That's one of the things I think about art, is that these works are intentionally made to be shared.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. You know, I also am thinking in listening to you about this panel I witnessed once with the Dalai Lama on it, speaking about art. It was at Emory University. It was sponsored by the art department, so that's why the topic was there. And the first question was something I have been asked in some form or another many, many, many times, which is, do you believe great art has to come from great suffering? And which is a very Western, you know, notion.
Very Western.
You know,
notion,
the tortured artist and all that. And, so on the panel with the Dalai Lama was the writer Alice Walker and Richard Gere, the actor. So they spoke first, and Alice Walker said when she'd been younger, that had been like her mentors had been very much coming from that perspective. And and she just believed it. But then as she got older and happier, she thought her poetry was getting better. And Richard Gere talked about being an angry young man. And the whole time the Dalai Lama was looking a little perplexed, as he sometimes does when the question itself is so out of his, you know, way of seeing. And finally, he basically said, people are always taking me places and showing me like buildings or paintings or things and saying, isn't it beautiful? And he said, in the Tibetan culture, we believe like the beauty or the worth of a piece of art depends on what happened to the creator in the process of making it. Like, did they get kinder? Did they get smarter in sense of, you know, more enlightened? You know, that's what really is the worth of something. And it was really fascinating.
A very different perspective.
It's a very different perspective.
Very different perspective. But there has been a lot of suffering by artists, but it's not the sole reason they produce. I think one of the things in my talks and teachings around art and medicine has been the fact that I have a whole lecture, actually five lectures, on artists with illnesses and how all of them overcame or pushed through. Matisse created a new style of art. He did the cutouts after he couldn't stand anymore because of cancer. And, you know, there are thousands and thousands of examples. But the important thing to realize is that artists can't stop making art. This is who they are. This is their being. This is their essence. And so they push through the pain. Even Georgia O'Keeffe, when she became blind with macular degeneration, went on to not paint anymore, but to create sculptures.
Oh, I have so many friends who are hearing this. They're going to just resonate deep in their souls, you know, like, yes, you know, I can't stop.
I can't stop. I mean, and they can't stop. It's a drive in their spirit, in their soul.
And that's great. So now I'm curious about when you first encountered formal meditation practice?
Wow. That is a great question. I was lucky enough to go to the Seattle Art Museum in the 1980s. And when I was there, I was, they have one of the great Asian collections in the United States. So I started studying Buddhism and Hinduism through the works of art. And then in 1990, I moved to Berkeley and California and worked at the University Art Museum Pacific Film Archives. And a friend of mine, Jacqueline Bass, was took us on a retreat over at the Green Gulch Zen Center. And I suddenly really fell in love, to be really honest about that. Mm-hmm. It was an amazing transformation for me, because I realized that I could do this, not very well, but that mm-hmm. this open, that I could settle my mind, and it was, I enjoyed the breathing. I didn't enjoy the pokes in the backs, which did happen in the Zen Center. You know, trying to keep me awake, but it was a great introduction. And then when I moved to Dallas in 2000, what happened is there's virtually nothing here. I mean, it was a desert. Mm. And so I had these connections and went back to Berkeley for over 2 years to continue my practice with a group of people in a series called Awake. And this brought together artists and meditation teachers. And we met at Green Gulch, and I met a whole raft of wonderful people. And out of that came several books, including ones you may know called The Buddha Mind in Contemporary Art and The Smile of the Buddha. So this direct connection between art and Buddhism was being made, and it was very fulfilling for me. My son, David Gellis, whom you know, mm-hmm. has been a big influence in my life. David picked up his first book on Buddhism off my desk in Sausalito, California, when I was working on an exhibition on Japanese Buddhism. And he read it, and it, as you know, transformed his life. Mm-hmm. And we went on to study at the Zen Center, of course. And when he went back to the university, Boston University, he went on to India to take his junior year abroad. I was afraid I'd never see him again, mm-hmm. but I would call and they would say, no, the monks would tell me, no, David, not here, under the Buddha tree, under the Bodhi tree.
Oh.
So I very, very rarely got to talk to him. But David came back transformed by this experience, and ultimately wrote a book called Mindful Work, and has had columns in the New York Times where he's a reporter. So his influence on me has been profound. He also gave me, when I got sick in 2008, books by you, Sharon, and mm-hmm. also by Jon Kabat-Zinn, his the book about what is it called?
The full catastrophe.
Yeah, yeah. Which made me realize I was not alone in my suffering, and mm-hmm. that I could change my relationship to pain. And your teachings also transformed my life, because it opened my heart to accepting the new body that I had. But I've been attracted to meditation because it's a practice that's available to all of us. Mm-hmm. It can reduce stress, increase calmness and clarity, and most of all, for me, promote happiness.
Well, that's beautiful. Let's talk about the chapter of your life when you were first affected by chronic illness.
I had been healthy most of my life and was off in February of 2008 negotiating a big show for King Tutankhamun for 11 other art museums. And I was in Austria meeting the Egyptian delegation. And I felt like I got the flu there. I wasn't really sure. Then I went on to London and was definitely getting sicker and came home early. And when I came home, everybody, including my doctors, thought, oh, you just have the flu, you're coughing. Mm. And then finally, when I couldn't speak anymore and all I could do was cough, I went to see, a much better physician, who was a specialist in this area, Dr. Rosenblatt. And, he helped me to realize that this was a very unusual circumstance going on. And I struggled for a number of years to stay on as the director of the Dallas Museum of Art. And every time I would go to gatherings or openings, I would come away sick and go back into the hospital because I just couldn't manage being around other people without picking up their infections. So finally, and I was angry, Sharon. I mean, I was really angry at my body and at myself because it was failing me. And I had the job of my dreams. I was happy doing it. It gave me great fulfillment, but my body just got weaker and weaker until finally in 2012, I retired. And then I decided to rest and recover for a short period of time. I never listened to my body. I always would push through it and go back to work too early, my doctors would say. And happily for me, around that time, the University of Texas hired me. And because teaching schedule is public, but not as public as being an art museum director, I was able to succeed and begin teaching at the medical school at UT Southwestern and also at the Center for Brain Health. So my life changed. But the illness is still with me today, 13 years later. It's just a part of who I am. And now I accept it. In the morning, I get up and do a body scan. I don't get up. I look, after I open my eyes, I think, what a gift it is that I'm here and I'm breathing, even though every breath hurts almost like 1,000 knives going in and out with each breath. And that pain of breathing is a source of life for me. It is keeps me aware of always of what is present in my life. My choice is not to live in pain. My choice is to live in joy. And so I think the illness has given me gifts that are way beyond anything that I could have ever really understood. It is, I've learned to live with the pain and I've changed my relationship to it. So that's where I am today.
It's amazing. I mean, especially, you know, not that it was the same cause of the illness, you know, but look at our time, you know.
And I know.
And the struggles and, you know, the fear and you know, some people really struggling with long haul COVID and, you know, and just like so many things that are prevalent around that issue.
The number of complications that I've experienced as a result of, I take 40 medications a day and I do nebulizers six times a day. And so the nebulizers are a gift because it's when I practice metta. And so I used to, when I was working at the museum, I wouldn't do that. I would just plow through and do emails while I was trying to get air into my lungs. But, today, I don't do that. I relax and just, you know, meditate for that period of time because I have to let the medications come into my body so that I can go for another four or five hours.
And I just have to say that, you know, this is not a visual medium, but looking at you, you know, since we're friends or looking at a photo of you, you don't look haggard, you know, or like you're, you know, sometimes, of course, with pain.
Yes.
The tendency we have is to tighten up the whole rest of our body to almost try to thrust it out or something. And so we've added tremendous stress and tension to the pain. And, you know, I look at you and you're kind of radiant, actually.
Thank you, Sharon. Well, I think a lot of that comes from my practice of doing something new, you know, and also the way I greet each day. we have tremendous power over our brains. We may not have a lot of power, I've learned, over your body, but I've learned through all these years of meditation that even like this February, I had a terrible accident, was in the hospital for 6 weeks, and I listened to you and John for hours and hours at a time as I was recovering from surgeries and going through trying to learn to walk again. And, you know, I could have sat there. A lot of the nurses would say, you know, a lot of people would just sit there and be miserable, but you get up out of, you want to know when can you get up out of your chair, your bed, and when can you walk, and when can you go down, and what is there on this floor that we can look at that we've never seen before? they would just, you know, it gave them hope. And of course, I was in the hospital during COVID time, so I could have no visitors, and I lived on a lifeline of text messages and video calls. I mean, that was all I had.
I'm wondering about this practice you just sort of referred to a little bit about doing something new each day, and where that came from.
Well, it was on very specifically July the 8th, 2011. I got a call from my physician that they had done a biopsy and that they found that this was 2.5 years after I got sick, that the virus was growing in my lung and that it would continue to grow. We would see new specialists at all the great clinics around the country, but it was unknown what I had. And so I remember just leaning against my car in the parking lot and going, this isn't a real phone call that's happening to me. But I was picking up my brother at the airport. And when I got home, I told him this story and said, I think I'm going to have a glass of wine and take a rest. And that's what I did. And when I woke up, I always keep a pad of paper by my bedside. And I wrote down the practice. I'm going to do something new every day. I'm going to take an ordinary day and make it extraordinary through the power of intention. I can meet new people. I can go to new places. I can have new experiences and do new things with my friends. These experiences could be big or little, and new flavors of ice cream count. I don't know why I wrote that down, but I'm so grateful because I've had thousands of them. I cannot carry forward. So in a day that I do 3 or 5 things, I can't carry them to the next day. And I cannot count medical or work experiences. That would be too easy. So it was a way for me to start my life anew, if you can imagine, and to see if I could do this for more than a few days. I thought, oh, I'll do this for a week or two. But the focus for me would be on beauty and joy and gratitude and connecting with people. And now I've been doing it for 3,703 days.
My goodness. Do you ever get to like the end of the day and think, well, I guess there's always ice cream, like you said.
There's always ice cream, but it only counts the first time, Sharon. So last night I had passion fruit ice cream, which I'd never had. But, once I've had that scoop, it sits in there, and I often have ice cream parties. And also at the end of the day, at 11:45, I have a prepared drawer. Over the years, friends have given me games and toys to play with. One night I went out and danced in the light of the moon. Another time I went out, it was 11:50. I was writing a paper and I decided it was time to have a duck race in the pool. You know, I just needed to break my thinking patterns into a new way. So it's a gift to realize that it's brought a lot of play and joy into my life by intentionally doing something new every day.
It's so fantastic. And I think I wish I could see you every night at 11:50, you know, and just say, all right, only got 10 minutes.
I've only got 10 minutes. Yeah. Well, I post, as you know, I post them on Instagram, The Simple Pleasures of Living, and also on Facebook. And, it's just sort of a chronicle of of this journey of celebration. And when I wake up in the morning, as I said earlier, it takes me a lot of time to come into the world. I don't do well in the first morning, part of the morning, because I have so many medications and things that I have to do. And I have to attend to them, because if I don't do them, I'm not going to get through the day. So my focus in the morning, there's a wonderful quote by Montesquieu that says, "In the morning when I wake, that morning is filled with a secret joy. I see the light with a type of delight, and the rest of the day I am happy."
Wow.
So that's my morning mantra.
Well, wow. Well, you're especially, I mean, your practice and you are especially inspiring, because I think about, well, like you in the hospital when you couldn't get visitors.
Right.
You know, so much has been taken away from people in just the current circumstance. And you know, so there's limitations, there's real aloneness, there's physical pain. And yet, you know, listening to you, it feels so expansive. It's so open.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's true that, you know, life does not have to be the way it was or perfect. Life is never perfect, to be wonderful. And so I think, unlike a lot of people, I was really prepared for solitude, because there have been periods in my illness where both of my vocal cords were damaged and I couldn't speak for several months. And so I learned a lot about solitude and communicating in a different way. And what has helped me with my Do Something New practice is the celebration of little things in life that can become discoveries and lessons for the larger, for my life in a larger sense.
And I know that as the practice has evolved over time, you have expanded it considerably, and you're working alongside, now you're working alongside neuroscientists at the University of Texas at Dallas's Center for Brain Health. You are the director of Art Brain Innovations, you know, which is a great title. And you're also teaching now about the interplay of art and health at UT Dallas and UT Southwestern Medical School.
It's all true.
What is the director of Art Brain Innovations?
Yes.
Do?
What does it do? Well, I am very lucky that a dear friend of mine, Sandy Chapman, invited me to give my very first lecture on Do Something New. I went over and was visiting with her, and I told her about my practice. This was when I was only about 2 years into it. And she said, "Oh my gosh, do you understand how important this is to the development of the neuroplasticity and the dopamines and everything?" These were all words I had never heard about. I mean, I didn't know anything about that. And so Sandy invited me in to give talks and presentations to staff and to the public. And they became more and more popular. And it taught me that brain health is just as important as the health of your body. And though we don't give it enough attention. And here I'm working with a wonderful team on my Do Something New practice to develop units that we can teach for a major 10-year study that the Center for Brain Health is doing, called the Brain Health Project, to help people improve their brains. And my sessions will deal with gratitude and nourishing relationships and all the different things that I do as part of the discoveries in my practice, and hopefully will lead to a way in which people who go through the practice in the Brain Health Project can develop new habits that will change their lives and help them to become better at developing novelty and curiosity in their lives.
What are the researchers finding in response to the brain encountering novelty?
Yeah, well, that was they have at the Center for Brain Health been very kind to me, because, as you know, I'm a lay person. I'm not a neuroscientist. I'm an trained art historian. I understand the concept of novelty because that's how great new trends in art, as we move through the history of our visual culture, the most dramatic being that we can remember is the move from realism to abstraction at the turn of the century, and then later in the 60s to abstract expressionism, where you didn't have to have a content to your painting. And so I understood the concept of that, but now I understand that novelty, by its very definition, is that it is something new to us, and it's a new experience, and it can take many forms. You can develop new skills, you can buy a new outfit, you can listen to new music, you can go traveling. All of these are novel experiences. But one of the great researchers here, Dr. Jeff Ling, who is the co-director of the Brain Health Study, points out that novelty is a contributor to improving our brain health. And when you do something new, you lay down new neural pathways that are associated with developing your memory, and our brains are plastic in that they can constantly build and renew themselves, and that these new neural pathways that we develop through the practice of doing something new can prevent things like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease, or diminish, not prevent them. I didn't mean to say that at all, but can help a person in those suffering from those diseases, mm-hmm. Because we're staying ahead of the problem rather than just focusing on trying to treat the patient. Novel experiences are critical to our brain. They're part of how we have our developed curiosity. They create new networks. They encourage our creativity. It's critical. The other thing that another scientist, Dr. Ian Roberts, pointed out is that dopamine, which is really critical to the development and the giving us spurts of new ideas, comes from doing something new, comes from novelty. And of course, novelty makes us happy when we do new things. Sometimes we succeed or fail, but this idea that we're developing pathways, we're expanding the use of dopamine to keep us motivated and living well. Without novel experiences, creativity, innovation, they begin to stop developing in our brains, especially when we get older. I'm 75 and doing this every day. So their insights have helped me to be encouraged about my practice and to put it into a new light, which I hope to write about in my new book.
Yes, I want to talk about your book in a second. But before we do, going back to kind of where we started this conversation, it seems that to me that the novelty doesn't have to be something dramatic. It could be Monet looking at a turn of the light.
Yes.
On the same old object, you know, mm-hmm. but that change in the light is mm-hmm. actually a significant shift.
And that's exactly what Do Something New is about. It's just like meditation. It's about the intention to notice it, that you're out there seeking these things, mm-hmm. Looking for these special moments. And it's the ability to focus with attention when it happens, and to record it. I take thousands of photographs. I have 55,000 photographs on my little iPhone.
Really?
Yes, recording my days as I go through them. And at night, I might write about one of them, but there are always five or six events that have happened. And it's
Can't accumulate, right? You
can't. Yeah, I can't write that many. It takes a lot of time to write these little. For me, I try to be very thoughtful, but I write them down or I photograph them. And it is the hook here is just like Monet. It's the intention to look and absorb the ideas. And it's the attention it takes to really be fully present and capture them and remember them. And so that combined experience can make for something new to do.
I think that's so important, because otherwise we get into that spiral of like, I need radical change right now. I need more stimulation. You know, I need, mm-hmm. I can't look at that old haystack anymore. You know, it's like too much. So tell me about your book.
Well, I've started, one of the things I decided to do is actually mention the fact that I was going to write the book to you today and to the listeners, because it will make it manifest itself. But I've started the draft, which is really talking about how I came to practice Do Something New, and talks about the discoveries I've made about self-compassion, because I was so angry with myself for so long, and then have learned to really accept myself and to be patient and allow my body to heal, to do the miracle that can happen if you just allow it to happen, to be constantly seeking new relationships with friends, even with old friends. When they come over and visit for a cup of tea, I'll say to them, "You're my something new today." And they go, "Oh no," because it means I want to know something about that person that I've never known before. Oh. And you can get, tell me about your mother and your relationship with your mother or your father or your children, or what is something I don't know about you? In my case, many listeners would never expect that I was a great sailor, which I was for a long period of time. So I seek out those moments to really focus on. But the book is basically going to be about resilience, you know, how there can be a lot of obstacles in front of us, and bad stuff happens to all of us, and it does. But you can learn to accept it and to move forward and to start again. And just like meditation, in life, you need that ability to take two steps forward and four back, and then two forward and two forward and two forward and then three steps back. Mm-hmm. It's not a straightforward path, but it is a path that can be beautiful and inspiring if you allow yourself to open your heart to it and to others that are around you. So those key discoveries of playfulness, joyfulness, gratitude, compassion will be parts of the story in the book.
It's really exciting.
So you have to remind me to get it done.
I will completely remind you, because I think it will be such a huge service, really, and fun to read too.
Yeah.
You know, you can list some of the ice cream flavors. Now, how many days have you been doing Do Something New now, did you say?
I've been doing Do Something New for 3,703 today.
Wow.
3,703. So a little over 11. I've just started my 11th year.
Wow.
Yeah. And you're my Do Something New today. So even though I don't have the beautiful face in front of me, you know, I have the... everything else, you know, the microphones and other things. But I've been so excited to think about this session and sharing publicly my practice.
I think it's so fantastic. And I actually wanted to talk a little bit more about gratitude, because it's such a double-edged sword in a way. Like anyone who encounters chronic illness or some terrible thing in their life, and having someone else tell you to be grateful is so infuriating, you know, and off-putting. But there's clearly a way of approaching gratitude that feels authentic and useful and beautiful, you know, because it's so redemptive in a way. So can you say something more about how you approach gratitude?
I'm thinking about that, because my first reaction was to say, I'm so grateful that you asked that question.
Oh, yeah, no, that's good. But well, you're a living embodiment of how it can work, you know.
For me, the practice of gratitude is central to my practice of doing something new and doing meditation. It is a key to having a happy life, because if you're not grateful, then no matter how much you have, you're not going to be happy. And I want to be happy, and so I'm grateful that my eyes opened and that my feet landed on the ground, and that my brain is awake and writing new lectures. This week it was on cadavers and medical illustrations. You know, we know how important gratitude is in medical science because it develops a lot of our prefrontal cortex. And even the simple act of writing letters, which I do once a year, I write letters to thank people who have been a part of my life and given me so much courage and joy. But what I think people don't realize is that gratitude is a choice you can make. And you to be intentional about it and to pay attention to how what a special gift it is you know, whether it's that simple breath or you know, or a step forward, in my case, the spring. I love your phrase, Sharon, of reaching for the good when you think about gratitude. Mm-hmm. It's really, really important. And that goes back to why it's so central in my practice. It's a matter of intention and attention. And to be grateful means you are focusing on yourself and on others. And like self-compassion and compassion, it is that huge gift that you can give in life and give to yourself. For me, understanding that I have to listen to my body and understand that when I'm in too much pain, I can be grateful can sound a little crazy, but now at least I listen to those signals and I stop and work on healing as opposed to work on working. So I don't know whether that makes a lot of sense, but it's absolutely central to my practice. And I know so many times people will tell me, oh, if you only took Chinese herbs or if you only did this, you know, you would get well. I'm not going to get well. This is who I am. And so I have learned to choose to be grateful that I'm here and to act with joy every day of my life.
No, that's wonderful. It does make a lot of sense, you know, and it's also in the context of, it's very powerful in the context of how gratitude is often perceived, you know, that it means you'll settle for crumbs, you'll settle for less. It's an oppressive tool in some people's minds, and I suppose in some contexts it could be, you know, and yet it's such a mark of resilience and the vitality of the life force and a better way to live.
I know it's the way you choose to live your life. You know, you give so many examples of this in your teaching, but one of the my annual New Year's resolution now is very simple: to live life with joy.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm not joyful, I go, "What's going on?" You know, and I stop if I can. Sometimes I'm stuck in a meeting and I can't get out, but but I can start thinking about other things because I'm not joyful in that moment, and so I'm so grateful that I have developed this capacity to recognize what for me is joy. It can be big or little, but I'm grateful that I can understand that. And through that understanding, then I can move intentionally to a new place.
It's really beautiful. And I am very grateful that we've had a chance to connect and have this conversation. And I'm wondering if you would lead us in a guided reflection of some kind.
Yes, I'm honored to be asked for this opportunity. As I mentioned to you, Sharon, I'm not a meditation teacher. I've been practicing meditation for a long time, and I hope you all will be gentle with me. I chose a loving kindness meditation in your honor, which is one I say often all day long, especially when I'm doing my nebulizers, because it focuses on the interconnectedness in life and the repetition, the silent repetition of the phrases. of our gifts of giving, of offering, and of blessing to ourselves and to others. And that is so powerful for me. So I'm just going to turn our attention to ourselves and ask that we all sit comfortably and to settle in. If you can, straighten your back and feel the energy in your spine and the groundedness of your feet on the floor. And you can close your eyes or not. But just settle in and feel the release through your breath. Let's start with our breath going in and breathing out. This is a moment in your life, that breath. Your mind will wander, as Sharon's advice always reminds me. When I notice this, then I rest my attention on those thoughts and bring them lightly back like a butterfly landing on a flower. Don't worry if you lose your focus on your breath. First, we'll offer blessings to ourselves. May I be happy. May I be safe. May I be healthy. May I live life with ease. Repeat these quietly. Rest in your body with the slow in and out of your breathing in your diaphragm. Pause before you let your breath out. And then gently, gently let go and release. Now think of someone who has inspired you, someone who makes you smile, and bring them into your mind and offer the phrases of loving kindness. May you be happy. May you be safe. May you be healthy. May you live life with ease. Repeat them gently as you breathe. And as you focus on your breath, remember that this is a moment of true life. You are here. You are present. You are with others. Now, let's call to mind someone who is struggling now. Bring them into your mind and hold their hands. Can you look them directly in the eye and offer phrases of loving kindness? May you be happy. May you be safe. May you be healthy. May you live life with ease. Repeat these phrases as you breathe and stay in this moment. Now let's call to mind all creatures, all beings, everywhere, near and far, known and unknown, the world that surrounds us in beauty. This is my favorite. As the chorus sings, may all things be happy. May all things be safe. May all things be healthy. May all things live with ease.
Well, thank you so much. It's so beautiful.
Thank you. I love these because the offering of this metta, because it's the only moment we have, and to be fully present and to rest in joy. And when we begin to open our eyes, you recognize that you've been given gifts of kindness and love and blessings to others. So that's why I love this meditation so much, Sharon, and thank you for teaching it to me, and thank you to the audience for listening.
Oh, well, thank you so much for coming. And to learn more about Bonnie's work, visit www.dosomethingnew.org or check her out on Instagram at Bonnie Pittman, BonniePittman. Thank you all for listening. This has been the Metta Hour podcast from the Be Here Now Network. May you be safe, be happy, be healthy, and may you live with ease.
Hey, folks. Thanks for listening. To learn more about Sharon and her ongoing teaching schedule, as well as online courses and a free guided meditation, check out her website at sharonsalzberg.com.